Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Bill Walton. Today, I will be reading from the June 2024 issue of The Atlantic. This first article is written by Shirley Lee and is titled The Engrossing Darkness of The Crow. Can a cult hit point the way forward for the beleaguered comic book movie? The superhuman protagonist of The Crow, the comic book movie that went on to become a cult hit after its release 30 years ago, doesn't relish being undead and invincible. When he first shows his face on screen, Eric Draven, played by Brandon Lee, is crawling out of his own grave in near feral agony. His fingers claw at the mud around his tomb. His clothes, drenched by rain, cling to his skin. He never gets to his feet. Instead, he writhes on his back, screaming in pain. To say this isn't a standard superhero's welcome is an understatement, but then, The Crow didn't care to obey the genre's conventions. Grim, stylish, and brazenly violent, the film is a gothic fable about a young rock musician and his girlfriend, who, on the eve of their wedding, are murdered. When Draven, the former heavy metal guitarist, is resurrected from the dead a year later by a mystical crow, just go with it, he's not a noble crime fighter, but a wounded predator hunting the killers. They're all dead, he snarls. They just don't know it yet. The Crow premiered in 1994, at a moment when superhero films themselves appeared to be in dire shape. Gone were the shiny Superman movies of the 1970s and 80s. In Batman Returns, released in 1992, Tim Burton refined his approach to the genre's aesthetic, less spandex, more noir, and delivered a much grittier story. But his Batman sequel fell far short of the box office bar set by his predecessor in 1989. Films based on Marvel Comics were forgettable, and although the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie was successful, it was intended for children. Producing mainstream comic book-based entertainment posed a challenge for the studios. Could a hero be fresh but familiar enough to spawn the next great franchise? Before it began production, The Crow may have looked like an ideal solution. Based on an acclaimed, if niche, series of comics by James O'Barr, the adaptation had secured a handsome rising star in the 28-year-old Lee. The story seemed straightforward enough. It had a sentimental core and incorporated a handful of lighter, more accessible supporting characters to balance the darker themes. But the finished film, steeped in the director Alex Proyas' grungy vision, and clouded by Lee's tragic death after an accident on set, turned out to be a singular and strange phenomenon. Its melancholic mood and theme are worth remembering as a remake arrives in theaters this month, at a time of dwindling box office returns for Marvel and DC Comics. For fans who have tired of tidy morals, formulaic action, and flashy effects, The Crow of three decades ago offers an antidote, proof that the comic book genre can be a vehicle for a wrenching evocation of human suffering. In retrospect, Lee's fate, a prop gun loaded with blanks, malfunctioned, causing a projectile to hit him in the abdomen, as largely eclipsed his remarkable performance in The Crow, which is crucial to the film's jarring power. He delivers hokey one-liners with hard-edged gusto. He moves balletically across the screen, imbuing Draven with an unexpected softness. He shed 20 pounds before filming began, and his gauntness signaled his character's difference, not just in appearance but in ethos, from hunkier comic book heroes. Caught in an abyss of grief, Draven is menacing but vulnerable. Delirious enough to paint himself in black and white harlequin makeup for his murderous missions, but too stricken to reconnect fully with who he had been before his death. Even in lighter scenes, Lee quietly conveys that Draven is so consumed by sadness he can't see beyond revenge. The film's prevailing visual and sonic grammar foregrounds bleakness, motion, and noise. Drawing from the story's ink and page origins, The Crow presents a Detroit that seems permanently covered in grime and shrouded in mist, with kinetic camera work exaggerating the city's angular alleyways. Burton's Batman had already begun challenging the superhero's genre's gaudier impulses, but The Crow takes the shadowy tableaus to another level. Proyas spent his early career directing moody music videos for artists such as Sting and Crowded House. Here, he assembles a film that looks like a mid-90s rock video. It sounds like one, too. The soundtrack includes Nine Inch Nails, The Cure, and Violent Femmes. Every serious comic book movie since has likely borrowed something from The Crow, whether it's the smoky aesthetics or the abrupt needle drops. O'Barr wrote the original comics after a drunk driver killed his fiancée, who tried to purge his anger on the page, only to discover that his suffering grew as he worked. The pain carries over into the film. The Crow contains enough moments to suggest the shape of a traditional comic book tale, including energetically staged fight scenes, antagonists with absurd code names, and even a catchphrase for Draven. It can't rain all the time, but the overarching and arresting effect is to leave the audience shaken rather than to offer resolution. Unlike other superhero projects, the movie's narrative is not about good prevailing over evil, or about the indestructible Draven using his great power responsibly. By the end of the film, he has left a bloody trail in his ultimately triumphant pursuit of the criminals who attacked him and his fiancée, Shelley, played by Sophia Shinas, and he has nowhere to go but back to his grave. There, he's embraced by Shelley in a vision, which may seem like a happy conclusion. The couple reunited, justice served. But Draven's crusade never restores them to life together. If anything, his recurrent hazy, half-formed flashbacks suggest that Shelley has become nothing more than a memory that hounds him, fueling his fury and angst. Perhaps it's wrong even to call The Crow a superhero film. It's a reconfiguration of the form, an assertion that such movies don't have to be mere vessels for quippy dialogue and eye-popping effects. They can invite viewers to examine human nature as its own wildly unpredictable force. Our feelings underscore our humanity, but they can be overpowering too, imprisoning rather than liberating us. Made for roughly $23 million, The Crow went on to net more than $50 million in the United States. It yielded several unremarkable sequels, each a reminder of just how a rare asset the original had in Lee's fierce yet nuanced performance. None achieved the first film's unsettling blend of corrosive emotion and concussive action. But Hollywood hasn't been able to resist the allure of remaking the original. Efforts to introduce a new Eric Draven to audiences have been underway since the late 2000s, and the parade of actors rumored to have almost played him over the years is impressive. It includes Oscar nominees Bradley Cooper, Ryan Gosling, men cast as other superheroes, Jason Momoa, Nicholas Hoult, and Alexander Skarsgård, whose younger brother Bill, best known for his work as the murderous clown Pennywise in the latest It films, will soon actually make it to the screen in the role. The comic book film's genre's garish to grim cycles have become familiar, but The Crow endures because it upended expectations and ignored conventional boundaries. A legacy like that is inviting and daunting. In an interview conducted during the film's production, Lee explained why he wanted to play Draven and bequeathed some useful wisdom, or perhaps a warning, to successors. "There are no rules," he said, "about how a person who has come back from the dead is going to behave." Now, that article titled "The Engrossing Darkness of the Crow" was written by Shirley Lee, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. This next article is written by Megan O'Rourke and is titled "Hypochondria Never Dies." The diagnosis is officially gone, but health anxiety is everywhere. At breakfast the other week, I noticed a bulging lump on my son's neck. Within minutes of anxious Googling, I'd convinced myself that he had a serious, undiagnosed medical condition, and the more I looked, the more apprehensive I got. Was it internal jugular phlebectasia, which might require surgery, or a sign of lymphoma, which my father had been diagnosed with before he died? A few hours and a visit to the pediatrician later, I returned home with my tired child in tow, embarrassed but also relieved. The problem was just a benignly protuberant jugular vein. My experience was hardly unique. We live in an era of mounting health worries. The case of online medical self-diagnoses has given rise to what's called cyberchondria, concern fueled by consulting Dr. Google that escalates into full-blown anxiety. Our medical system features ever more powerful technologies and proliferating routine preventive exams, scans that peer inside us, promising to help prolong our lives, blood tests that spot destructive inflammation, genetic screenings that assess our chances of developing disease. Intensive vigilance about our health has become the norm, simultaneously unsettling and reassuring. Many of us have experienced periods of worry before or after a mammogram or a colonoscopy, or bouts of panic like mine about my son's neck. For some, such interludes become consuming and destabilizing. Today, at least 4% of Americans are known to be affected by what is now labeled health anxiety, and some estimates suggest that the prevalence is more like 12%. And yet, hypochondria, you may be surprised to learn, officially no longer exists. In 2013, the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the so-called Bible of Psychiatric Conditions, eliminated hypochondriasis. The change reflected an overdue need to reconceive a diagnosis that people found stigmatizing because it implied that hypochondriacs are neurotic malingerers whose symptoms aren't real. The DSM introduced two distinct new diagnoses, illness anxiety disorder and somatic symptom disorder, both of which aim to be neutrally clinical descriptions of people with excessive worries about health. What differentiates them is the presence or absence of physical symptoms accompanying those fears. The timing of the writer Carolyn Crampton's new book, A Body Made of Glass, A Cultural History of Hypochondria, couldn't be better. What her belleristic account of hypochondria's long and twisting lineage sometimes lacks in authoritative rigor, it makes up for in vivid evocations of being a patient. Her youthful experience with cancer and the anxiety she has suffered ever since propel her undertaking. A tour that includes a sampling of evolving medical science about the condition, as well as literary reflections from, among others, John Donne, Baudelaire, Marcel Proust, Virginia Woolf, and Philip Larkin, on the doubt and fear that are inseparable from life in a body that gets sick. Hypochondria, as Crampton highlights, is not just a lay term for a tendency to worry about illness that isn't there. It's a diagnosis that has existed for hundreds of years. The attendant symptoms and meanings have shifted continually, always in step with changing conceptions of wellness and disease. In that sense, the history of hypochondria reflects one constant. Each era's ideas track its limited understanding of health and demonstrate a desire for clarity about the body and illness that again and again proves elusive. Knowing this doesn't stop Crampton from dreaming of a definitive test for everything, including health anxiety itself. Hippocrates, known as the father of medicine, used the term hypochondrium in the 5th century BCE to identify a physical location, the area beneath the ribs, where the spleen was known to lie. Hippocratic medicine held that health depended on a balance among four humors, blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm, that affected both body and mind. By the 17th century, the notion of hypochondria as a fundamentally physical condition that also had mental symptoms had been firmly established. In The Anatomy of Melancholy, in 1621, the English writer and scholar Robert Burton described it as a subset of melancholia, noting a splenetic hypochondriacal wind accompanied by sharp belchings and rumbling in the guts, along with feeling fearful, sad, suspicious, an illness that, as he put it, crucifies the body and mind. Physicians in the 18th century began to investigate hypochondria as a disorder of the recently discovered nervous system, accounting for symptoms not just in the gut, but in other parts of the body as well. According to this view, the cause wasn't imbalanced humors, but fatigue and debility of the nerves themselves. A fundamental shift had taken place by the late 19th century, thanks to the emergence of views that went on to shape modern psychology, including the idea that, as Crampton puts it, the mind controlled the body's experiences and sensations, not the other way around. Distinguished by what the neurologist George Beard, in the 1880s, called delusions, hypochondria was reconceived as a mental illness. It was a psychological state of unwarranted concern with one's health. In the 20th century, the prototypical hypochondriac became the kind of neurotic whom Woody Allen plays in Hannah and Her Sisters, someone who obsessively thinks they are sick when they're not. Freud's view that unexplained physical symptoms can be the body's expression of inner conflict, meaning that those symptoms could be entirely psychological in origin, played an influential role. The idea that stress or anguish could manifest as bodily distress in a process that came to be called somatization spread. So did 20th century medicine's new capacity to test for and rule out specific conditions. Consider Allen's character in that film, fretting about a brain tumor, only to have his worries minimized by a brain scan. This newly psychologized anxiety, juxtaposed with medical science's objective findings, helped solidify the modern image of the hypochondriac as a comedic figure, easily caricatured as a neurotic who could, and should, just snap out of it. Unlike some other forms of anxiety, health worries are a problem that neither better labels nor improved treatments can hope to completely banish. Hypochondria, the writer Brian Dillon pointedly notes in his The Hypochondriacs, 9 Tormented Lives, ultimately makes dupes of us all because life, or rather death, will have the last laugh. In the meantime, we doubt, wait, anticipate, and try to identify. Is that stabbing headache a passing discomfort or a sign of disease? Our bodies are subject to fluctuations, as the medical science of different eras has understood, and as today's doctors underscore. The trick is to pay enough attention to those changes to catch problems without being devoured by the anxiety born of paying too much attention. In retrospect, Crampton, as a high school student in England, wasn't anxious enough, overlooking for months a tennis ball-sized lump above her collarbone that turned out to be the result of Hodgkin's lymphoma, a blood cancer. Her doctor told her that she had a significant chance that treatment would leave her cancer-free. After chemo, radiation, one relapse, and a stem cell transplant, she got better. But the experience left her hypervigilant about her body, anxious that she might miss a recurrence. As she reflects, it took being cured of a life-threatening illness for me to become fixated on the idea that I might be sick. Her conscientious self-monitoring gave way to panicked visits to urgent care and doctor's offices, seeking relief from the thought that she was experiencing a telltale symptom, a behavior that she feels guilty about as a user of England's overstretched National Health Service. At some point, she writes, my responsible cancer survivor behavior had morphed into something else. What Crampton was suffering from, the something else, seems to be what the DSM now labels illness anxiety disorder, an excessive preoccupation with health that is not marked by intense physical symptoms. It applies both to people who are anxious without apparent cause or symptoms and to people like Crampton who have survived a serious disease that might recur and are understandably, but debilitatingly, apprehensive. It can be hard to distinguish this term, Crampton finds, from the DSM's other one, somatic symptom disorder, which describes a disproportionate preoccupation that is accompanied by persistent physical symptoms. It applies to people who exaggerate, the person with heartburn who grows convinced that she has heart disease, as well as those with a serious disease who fixate, to their detriment, on their condition. The definition makes a point of endorsing the validity of a patient's symptoms, whatever the cause may be. In this, it embodies a 21st century spirit of the non-judgmental acceptance. Yet, because it is a diagnosis of a mental disorder, it inevitably involves assessments of, among other things, what counts as excessive anxiety. Evaluations like these can be anything but clear-cut. Medicine's distant and not-so-distant past, when multiple sclerosis was often misdiagnosed as hysteria and cases of long COVID were dismissed as instances of pandemic anxiety, offers a caution against confidently differentiating between psychological pathology and poorly understood illness. In Crampton's view, the DSM's revision has turned out to be an excessive exercise in futility. Some physicians and researchers agree that the categories neither lump nor split groups of patients reliably or helpfully. A 2013 critique argued that somatic symptom disorder would pick up patients with chronic pain conditions and patients worrying about the prognosis of a serious medical condition, for example, diabetes or cancer, not to mention people with undiagnosed diseases. A 2016 study failed to provide empirical evidence for the validity of the new diagnoses, concluding that the use of the labels won't improve the clinical care of patients suffering from high levels of health anxiety. Hypochondria has only questions, never answers, and that makes us perpetually uneasy, Crampton writes. Still, she finds that she almost mourns the old term. Its imperfections fit her messy experience of anxiety and help her describe it to herself and doctors, giving edges to a feeling of uncertainty that she finds overwhelming. But her position, she acknowledges, is a privileged one. As a former adolescent cancer patient, she gets care when she seeks it and doesn't really have to worry about being stigmatized by doctors or friends. Crampton's concerns and her experience, that is, are legible to the medical system, to all of us. But that is not true for the millions of patients, many of them young women, suffering from fatigue or brain fog, who struggle to get doctors to take their symptoms seriously, and turn out to have a condition such as myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, or an autoimmune disease. They, too, are pulled into the story of hypochondria. Yet the DSM's labels largely fail to solve the problem these patients encounter. In the long shadow of Freud, we are still given to assuming that what clinicians call medically unexplained symptoms are psychological in origin. 15-minute appointments in which doctors often reflexively dismiss such symptoms as indicators of anxiety don't help. How can doctors usefully listen without time or medical training that emphasizes the bounds of their own knowledge? This omission is the real problem with the DSM's revision. It pretends to have clarity we still don't have, decisively categorizing patients rather than scrutinizing medicine's limitations. The challenge remains. Even as evidence-based medicine laudably strives to nail down definitions and make even finer classifications, patients and practitioners alike need to recognize the existential uncertainty at the core of health anxiety. Only then will everyone who suffers from it be taken seriously. After all, in an era of pandemics and Dr. Google, what used to be called hypochondria is more understandable than ever. Someday we might have the longed-for definitive test or a better set of labels, but right now we must acknowledge all that we still don't know, a condition that literature, rather than medicine, diagnoses best. As John Donne memorably wrote in the throes of an unknown illness, now suspected to have been typhus, "Variable and therefore miserable condition of man. This minute I was well and am ill. This minute." Now that article titled "Hypochondria Never Dies" was written by Megan O'Rourke, who is the editor of the Yale Review and the author, most recently, of The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 2024 issue of The Atlantic. I am Bill Walton. So long until next time.